Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Nuclear power and nuclear energy and nuclear weapons have been contentious issues since the time they arrived on the scene in the 20th century. We have as our guests this hour Arne and Maggie Gunderson. Arne is one of the leading nuclear experts and nuclear whistleblowers. Arne Gunderson has more than 40 years of nuclear power engineering experience. He attended Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, where he earned his bachelor's while also becoming a recipient of a prestigious Atomic Energy Commission fellowship for his master's degree in nuclear engineering. Arne Gunderson holds a nuclear safety patent, was a licensed reactor operator, and is a former nuclear industry senior vice president. During his nuclear power industry career, Arne Gunderson also managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the U.S. He's continued to consult on nuclear power issues for the Sierra Club, the state of Vermont, where he was the chair of the Public Oversight Committee, and he has been a witness, an expert witness, for the New England Coalition around Vermont Yankee, where he was one of the original nuclear engineers. Maggie Gunderson, his wife, also has deep experience in the nuclear industry. She founded Fairwinds Associates, a group that they both are part of now, which provides expert witness services, and she also was a spokesperson and has expertise in the nuclear power industry itself. So, Arne and Maggie Gunderson, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you so much for having us, David.
I'd like to start with Arne, your journey through the nuclear power world. What first got you interested in going into the world of nuclear power?
I almost think it was preordained. When I was, I think, 6 years old, my mother took me down to the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and the Nautilus had just gone underneath the North Pole, and it was moored at the Brooklyn Navy Yard.
So this was a nuclear submarine.
The Nautilus was the first nuclear submarine and the first submarine to go underneath the North Pole. So at six, that was the era when I grew up after the bomb, but certainly nuclear power, Atoms for Peace, and all that. When I went to Rensselaer, I got interested in nuclear power because they had this thing called the energy shortage. A year after I graduated, we had gas lines, and everybody was afraid the world was running out of energy. Now, it was an unfounded fear. I mean, we have more renewables and other forms of energy now than we ever had back then. But the fear was we were running out of energy, and I went into nuclear engineering to almost as a religious desire to save the world from running out of energy.
That's an interesting idea, this religious zeal that the early nuclear industry was infused with, that kind of sensibility. What was the original promise of nuclear power when you went into it? You mentioned Atoms for Peace, but there were a lot of slogans that accompanied those early days.
Yeah, the two slogans, the one is the religious. We were called the nuclear priesthood. That was created in the 60s. But the most famous one is too cheap to meter. Mm-hmm. The nuclear electricity was supposed to generate power at such a low rate you wouldn't even need a meter on your house.
And this was what year? What years are we talking about that you first went into this?
Well, the first commercial-sized power plant started in 69, and I graduated my bachelor's in 71. So I was right on that very first wave of commercial power plants. I got out of my master's in 72, and that was the year Vermont Yankee started. So essentially, my professional career and Vermont Yankee started on the at the same time.
Were there, nuclear power as it evolved came to be very much the bane of the environmental movement. But what about at its beginnings? Did the environmental movement kind of see this as a problem?
Out in California, they certainly did. I mean, the very foundation of Friends of the Earth and Sierra Club were very active in fighting the nuclear power plants in California. I think in some other areas, though, there were disagreements within the environmental community about, is nuclear bad, is nuclear good, and in comparison to coal or oil. You know, I never really got into the environmental effects, with the exception of the wastewater. The nuclear plants turn out more hot water than any power plant in existence. And so I was always worried about the hot water. So I did my master's thesis on cooling towers. Look at the Connecticut River, for that matter. You know, the hot water that's thrown out from a nuclear plant is worse than a coal plant, an oil plant, a gas plant, any of them.
So you're saying the first nuclear plant in the U.S. came online in 1969. By the late 70s, we're already into the era of the China Syndrome, the movie that Jane Fonda starred in about a nuclear meltdown, and Three Mile Island, which was a partial meltdown in Pennsylvania. What year was that?
That was 79. And, you know, partial meltdown is like being partially pregnant. You know, it melted down. You know, Maggie and I met on a nuclear job in upstate New York in 78. And by then, the nuclear boom was over. Maggie and I were on the project that was the last nuclear plant ever contracted for. It never got built. But what was already happening by 78, 79 is that costs were skyrocketing. I mean, plants that were supposed to cost $100 million were coming in at $2 billion. And schedules that, you know, thought you could build these things in 4 years were taking 10. So a lot of people think Three Mile Island killed the nuclear industry, but the last order was well before Three Mile Island.
Maggie Gunderson, your journey into the nuclear industry has a little bit different roots than Arnie's. Talk about what drew you to nuclear power, committing your life to nuclear power in the early days.
I was part of an organization, a volunteer group of women for energy independence, and I thought with Eisenhower and Atoms for Peace and a whole movement against nuclear proliferation and weapons, that the way to do that is using atoms for a peaceful purpose. I was really duped in that because there's just really no way to manage nuclear power, whether it's storing the waste or long-term operation of plants. It's too much of a risk. But I went into it thinking that I was doing the right thing. When there's an energy shortage in this country and in the world, the first people to suffer from that are women and minorities who lose jobs in cutbacks. And my concern started from that sort of pink ghetto place of getting out of school. Also, during the energy crisis and finding it so difficult as a woman to find work that I could even pay rent with. I mean, I was a journalist and a newspaper reporter, and then I went into teaching because it was just really, really hard to do anything. And today, that's still one of the biggest issues. Women are paid significantly less than men.
So you really were motivated by a feminist case for nuclear power in the beginning.
Yeah. In the beginning, that's how I was motivated, yes.
Were there a lot of women flocking to the nuclear industry for similar reasons?
There were, and there are still. There's a whole organization of women in nuclear power, and many women who are good at science or good at math are drawn into some kind of engineering, and nuclear engineering is very, very appealing, or physics is very appealing in those instances. And when they get out, the jobs are all in industry and in energy, and they're used to promote the industry as a tool. I was used as a tool.
How were you used?
Oh, I was on the front lines at community meetings. That's how I first met Arnie. I would have a meeting of maybe 250 people. It was in a very rural area. Plants are always located in rural areas. And 250 people upset that we were going to build another nuclear plant in that area. And they would say, well, you're only a PR person. We need someone with expertise. And I'd say, well, that's why I've asked Mr. Gunderson from our home office to come up here, and he'll speak to you. He has his bachelor and master degree in nuclear engineering. And, you know, he would come up and calm the audience down. But I was on the front lines there promoting the plants. And prior to that, I'd been working with nuclear engineers doing the core reload design work, which is managing how the fuel is put in to the reactor core for each fuel reload.
We're talking on the Vermont Conversation with Maggie and Arnie Gunderson. They are veterans of the nuclear industry and now some of its leading critics. And they work with a group that they founded called Fairwinds Education Fund and also the Fairwinds Associates. You can join this conversation by calling us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Maggie Gunderson, when did you start to feel uncomfortable about the work you were doing as a leading spokesperson for nuclear power?
I had a lot of discomfort in 1979 when Three Mile Island happened. I was pregnant with our first child, and we were only a couple hours drive from the plant where we were living. So I was really nervous about that, and everyone assured me, wrongfully, that no radiation was released. Containment held it all, and the containment system failed. Arnie can speak to that. He was an expert about expert witness on the Three Mile Island case for the plaintiffs. But, you know, that was a problem time for me. And from then on, I was questioning the industry.
Arnie Gunderson, so what was your role in Three Mile Island?
I was very pro-nuclear at the time. And the company I worked for actually put me on radio, and I was at television, actually, and I was telling people how everything was under control back in 2000. Of course, that changed as I became an expert at the trial back in 1993. So the accident was in 79, and I was on television. I actually said on television, the Titanic hit the iceberg, and the iceberg sunk. I believe these plants were so robust that nothing got out. But then as I started to dig in as an expert for the trial, for the plaintiffs, the 2,000 people in the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area that were irradiated, I realized, oh my God, all these things I said on the radio were wrong, and I was lied to. And I mean, if you can lie to a guy with a master's degree in nuclear engineering, it's, I firmly believe that my government went out of its way to cover up that disaster.
So the disaster occurred on March 28, 1979. When was it that you were representing the plaintiffs, the people who were affected by the radiation release?
Well, that's the turning point in our life happened in between there. But I represented the plaintiffs in 1993-95 as the litigation against the owner of the plant was going on. Yeah.
So talk about the turning point. This is when you became a whistleblower against the nuclear industry that you were a part of. Take us back to that time.
You know, I bought the party line hook, line, and sinker. I actually had a bumper sticker on my car: don't let Jane Fonda pull down your plant. I actually believe that the nuclear power was well regulated, and that if there were any mistakes, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would not just slap your wrist but throw you in jail. So now I progressed my way up. I was a senior vice president in 1990, working for a company that built the fuel racks at Vermont Yankee, and I've had people at 70 nuclear plants around the country. And I thought the system worked. I really bought the party line. And I found that our company was violating its license that it had with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I told the president of the company, and he fired me.
What exactly was the company doing that was violating its license?
Well, we had a license just to hold nuclear material. And I discovered that we were holding that nuclear material in the accounting safe, which was not where it was supposed to be. So we had radioactive material in the accounting safe.
What kind of radioactive material would be in a safe in an office?
Well, it didn't belong there. Well, the way we found it was that we were storing film in that safe, the photographic film, and the photographic film was getting fuzzy. And so then we realized that, oh, my God, there's four bottles of radioactive material in here. So the next thing I did was I went to the company's radiation safety officer to tell him about it, which is something you're required to have. When you have a license, you got to have this guy. And he had left the company 9 months before, and we didn't have this radiation safety officer. So there's a series. There's four or five things that I found wrong and told the president of the company about and was fired. So, you know, I still believe that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had my back, and I went to them, I filed the appropriate stuff, and they came up and did an inspection and said I was wrong. They said, none of these are not violations. Mr. Gundersen is absolutely wrong. Now, it pays to have a wife who's a reporter, and I think one of the key pieces in this transition was that Maggie was a reporter, because we were able to get some publicity. And that publicity led to John Glenn taking up an interest in this.
Senator John Glenn from Ohio.
Yes, a former astronaut who became a senator and who was another one of my boyhood idols. And he opened up an investigation of all the things that I talked about, because I was sure I was right. About 6 or 8 months later, the inspector general came back with a report that showed two things. It showed everything I said was right, and that a person on the NRC staff, and Maggie can tell you about him, but had gone out of his way and told his inspectors to botch the inspection. And the second thing he found, that the inspector general found, is that my employer was taking bribes. Well, it was giving bribes to the NRC inspectors. So that was, you know, that's one of those fundamental life-changing moments when an agency you really thought had the public's interest in mind went out of its way to screw the public.
And you were not just fired. You were receiving harassing phone calls. And other nuclear whistleblowers, famously Karen Silkwood, I believe it was out in Oklahoma, killed, run off the road on her way to meet a New York Times reporter. Things were going on around you to people like yourself.
Yeah, we had a good friend, Vera English, who was another whistleblower down in North Carolina. And she had found radiation in the ventilation system at the plant she was working in. And she came home from work one day in North Carolina, and her husband's picture was on the bed, and it was surrounded by bullets in a heart shape. You know, and, we know another woman who was hung in effigy behind the plant, and her dogs were poisoned on her front lawn. So, yeah, another woman who was had her drive shaft loosened so that on her way home it fell off and she drove into the ditch and almost killed herself.
Maggie Gundersen.
Arnie, I can't remember his name, but who was the journalist with the Houston Chronicle that did that major expose with all the whistleblowers?
Jim Morris. Jim Morris is a phenomenal. There's been a couple great reporters. Ted Wendling at Christian Science Monitor, and Jim Morris down in Houston. Morris turned to me. He was doing a big expose, 2 weeks worth of problems at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And he's down in Texas, of course, and I'm up in Vermont, and I'm up in Connecticut at the time. And he says, you know, Arnie, the other thing that happened is we were sued for $1.5 million by the company that I left, because we were continuing to talk about these safety violations. So Morris says to me, he says, you know, Arnie, down here we kill our whistleblowers. You Yankees sue them until they die, and I don't know which is worse.
You end up losing your job, and you go from being a senior vice president to a $20,000 a year job as a teacher and driving a dump truck. So what were some of the personal costs to you of being hunted and harassed?
Yeah, this is, it was an awful time. I mean, you know, I'm a father, our daughter was 8 and our son was 11. I can remember once our daughter broke her arm and we couldn't afford to get it x-rayed. And we had a great pediatrician who called the hospital. They opened the back door. We snuck our daughter in, got the x-ray. They gave us the films, brought us out the back door, and we never had to pay for the x-ray. So there were wonderful, heartfelt things like that. A couple times, you know, we went bankrupt. We lost our house in foreclosure. You know, my image of myself as a provider was awful. I was suicidal for more than a year. You know, it's just devastating to your ego to no longer be able to provide for your family. A couple times we'd walk down to the mailbox, though, and there'd be $500 in the mail anonymously. So those wonderful moments are now, as I get older, sort of displacing some of the terrible pain, especially about being a provider and not being able to take care of the kids and not being able to take care of Maggie and losing the house in the process. It's pretty damn hideous.
So this $1 million lawsuit they come at you with, harassing phone calls late at night, were there other things done to you?
Yeah, they hired a PI who followed us around, and you know, a couple times you notice a car following you at night, and one time there was a car parked at the end of the driveway, and I went chasing after that one, got away. We bought a big dog because we were afraid, you know, and this is back before caller ID, you know. It wasn't like the phone rings at 2 in the morning and you answer it, and it's not like you can trace the phone call.
And we lived way out in the country on 28 acres in the middle of the woods. So, yeah, if people came by or said something, they didn't belong there. You know it.
Yeah. Did you fear for your life, Maggie? Or for Arnie's life?
I feared for his life. You know, during the time we got to know some whistleblowers, because the attorney put them in touch with us and us with them, and the inspector general had all of us come together and testify together to him. So I knew some of the other stories. Ann Harris, who was down at Tennessee Valley Authority, her brake lines were cut, and she had a terrible car accident, and still to this day walks with a bad limp. Hmm. You know, other parts of the country, things were more violent, and, you know, it's a concern.
We're talking with Arnie and Maggie Gunderson. We're going to take a short break for the news, and when we come back, we'll talk about Vermont Yankee, which Arnie Gunderson was involved with, as well as Fukushima, where he has visited, and nuclear power today. We'll be right back after the news. Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. We're spending the hour with two of Vermont's leading energy experts and one of the world's leading nuclear energy safety critics. Arnie Gunderson is a veteran of the nuclear power industry and became a whistleblower in the early 1990s and has now been often seen on TV and elsewhere offering a counterpoint to views that the nuclear power industry is giving on issues relating to the Fukushima plant in Japan, as well as here in Vermont on the Vermont Yankee plant. And Maggie Gunderson, his wife, founded the group Fairwinds Energy Education, based here in Vermont. It consults around the world and educates on nuclear power issues. Arnie Gunderson, talk about your association with Vermont Yankee, the beginnings of it.
Well, when you become a whistleblower, I can tell you a quote from very famous nuclear attorney who I thought was my friend. He was a partner of Winston Strawn, which is one of the biggest law firms in the country on nuclear. And he said to me, Arnie, in this business, you're either for us or against us, and you just crossed the line. So now on the other side of the line, having all this knowledge, I realized how corrupt the system was, and I started working for different groups. Vermont Yankee was having a power increase. They called it an uprate. I'm trying to frame the argument positively. I'm going up, I guess, is good, but it really was they were trying to squeeze more power out of an old power plant. I went to work for New England Coalition on Vermont Yankee. There was all sorts of problems with that power increase. It was they wanted 20% more power without changing anything inside the power plant.
And what year was this?
It was in 2003, 2004. And they had, Entergy, the people that own Vermont Yankee, they're a pretty slick corporation, especially in the South, and they're used to getting their way. And the Vermont way is not that at all. So Maggie was a paralegal on the case for the coalition, and I was an expert. And on the stand, they tried to impeach me with evidence that I had not seen when I wrote my report. And anybody who's a lawyer says you don't do that to an expert. You give the expert all the information. Well, they withheld some information and then tried to make me look bad. And Maggie and I caught them at it. And they were fined $51,000 for that stunt. A little later in the process, they claimed that suddenly they had this need for a temporary building on the site. And I dug into the information, and Maggie got some paralegal help to sort all these piles and piles of information. And we found out they'd known it all along. And they were fined $82,000 for that stunt. So back in 2003, 2004, their image was tarnished. You know, they're a new kid on the block. They just owned the plant for a year. And, they're nailed with $130,000 in fines from the Public Service Commission because of the work that Maggie and I did. Yeah. And that was the beginning.
But the real beginning was you were involved in the early days of Vermont Yankee as a nuclear plant.
Oh, on the other side of the argument, yes. I was, as a vice president, I ran a construction division, and we built nuclear fuel racks. And one of our customers was the fuel racks for Vermont Yankee. It's just like a couple million-dollar project. And I can remember we forgot to weld 39 welds in a row on one of these fuel bundles, on one of the fuel rack cells. And later we discovered that we didn't have 39 welds. And I can remember being on the radio, this is back in 80, 81, saying, well, the system worked. We caught the mistake, and therefore that's why nuclear is safe. So, back when I bought the party line, hook, line, and sinker, I was providing materials to Vermont Yankee.
Did those welds get made?
No, they were placed in such a spot that we couldn't get back to them. They were impossible to get to. So we ran supercomputer models to show that even without those 39 welds, in the event of an earthquake, the fuel rack would hold together.
And now, do you believe those supercomputer models?
No. I also looked at some of our competitors' designs and told the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, about problems in the competitors' designs, similar problems, systemic problems, and they don't want to hear anything about it.
There has not been a nuclear plant built in the United States in how long?
Well, the first nuclear power plant in 25 years just came online this year. But it was started in 1970. So it took 45 years, but finally a power plant in Tennessee just came online at about $10 billion, and of course 45 years late. There's two others in Georgia and two others in South Carolina that are being built, and they're already $5-6 billion over budget and 3 or 4 years behind schedule. But they're in subsidized markets. You know, they're if they go over budget, the ratepayers pay. So the profits go to the stockholders, and the costs go to the people of South Carolina and Georgia. Very much a subset. The only places that are building nuclear power plants now are where ratepayers are carrying the risk and stockholders are getting the benefits.
You know, I'd ask you more about Vermont Yankee, but it does feel like kicking a dead horse at this point. Oh, Maggie, you're shaking your head no.
It's not kicking a dead horse because there are significant problems on site. The tritium leaks that have been discussed are a big problem. The tritium is migrating to the Connecticut River, and it's not the only radioactive isotope. So it's something that all Vermonters, when we have such a pristine state and we work so hard with organic farming and our entire economy is based on safe operation of many things, and to know that we could be destroying the aquatic life in that river, and that the aquifer near Vermont Yankee and near the Connecticut River is also at jeopardy from these leaks.
What is the ongoing threat to our area from Vermont Yankee? Arnie?
Well, I guess most of the Vermonters here will remember back in 2010 when a leak had been discovered at Vermont Yankee. The leak actually started in 2007, but there's radioactive tritium, radioactive strontium, radioactive cesium, radioactive cobalt got put into the groundwater. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is not making Vermont Yankee clean it up for 60 years. So it's moving toward the Connecticut River as we speak. That we've already discovered strontium, which is a really nasty bone seeker that causes all sorts of leukemias in the wells on site. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission says, well, nobody's drinking out of those wells. It doesn't matter. But at a minimum, what's happening is that the costs are rising to clean this plant up. And when that carcass is ultimately demolished, Vermonters are going to wind up carrying a higher cost. That's the minimum. If this strontium gets to the Connecticut River, you know, it's game over for things like fishing in the river.
More recently, you have been you visited Fukushima. Talk about what you saw in Fukushima and remind listeners what happened there.
Well, the Fukushima Daiichi reactor is identical to Vermont Yankee. And in March of 2011, there was a tsunami that prevented the plant from being cooled. And the fuel got incredibly hot, and the three reactors, you know, 1, 2, and 3, blew up. So that spread radiation upward into the air, and downward into the groundwater. They're still leaking out right now. This is 5 years later. Around 400 tons of radioactive water every day is leaking out into the Pacific, and they've also completely contaminated the mountainside. You know, I was there for a month back in February and March, and of this year, and so 5 years later. Imagine from Middlebury in the south to St. Albans in the north, from the lake all the way over beyond Mount Mansfield. A piece of land that size is so contaminated that it's not habitable. I was chasing radioactive monkeys and measuring the monkey droppings, and they're highly radioactive. The same with the cows and the wild boar that I was chasing as well. And people are being asked to come back in. What the Japanese government is doing is they moved out 160,000 people, and now they're taking their stipends away and saying, we're not going to pay you unless you go back to the house that you lived in which case we'll continue to pay you.
What is Fukushima? This was a medium-sized Japanese city. What does it look like today when you walk the streets?
Oh, it's a ghost town. You know, the traffic lights work, and there's nobody there. I walked down the street, and literally we were probably, I could walk for 10 or 15 minutes and wouldn't see anybody except the little group of scientists I was with. And, of course, all the stores, the doors are open, but there's nobody there. And the amazing thing is to see the streetlights going red and green and realizing, what's going on here? There's no traffic. You know, the government of Japan is run by a guy named Abe, who's the prime minister. And what's forcing this to happen is that he's very pro-nuclear, both pro-weapon and pro-nuclear power. And the banks have funded 5 years of every power plant in Japan being shut down. They want their money back. So the only way to get their money back is to fire up these power plants that have been shut down.
Nuclear plants.
Yeah, there probably is 50 nuclear plants that they've put in something on the order of $10 billion each. There's a lot of money on the line to get these power plants started back up, and the bankers want their money back.
So you're saying just the Fukushima plants have been shut down, not all nuclear plants?
No, all the nuclear plants in Japan are shut down.
50 nuclear plants?
There were six at Fukushima Daiichi and another four at Fukushima Daini, but the Japanese shut down 54 nuclear power plants, about 14 of which were determined to be so decrepit they'll never start them back up. But the other 40, there's an effort underway to get them running again.
Maggie?
And like the rural atmosphere of plants in the U.S., many of these plants are in rural areas. And that's the tax base for those communities. So they've had people that are out of work, all the areas around there need more money. There's not adequate taxes coming, even though the plants have been idled and a lot salaries of certain employees have been paid.
Do you think that all nuclear plants should be shut down?
Yes, I do. I came to that conclusion probably a decade ago from work I was doing with Dr. Helen Caldicott. And, you know, if we go back to the tritium issue for a minute, what I learned during that work is tritium crosses the placental barrier, it lodges in our organs, it stays in the body for up to 3 years. And the nuclear industry goes under an old standard that Arnie and I were both trained under, which is that it stays in the body about 50, 60 days, and you pee it out like water, and it doesn't do anything. And that's totally wrong. The science that's been in place for a decade shows the dangers. And when I started to evaluate all that, and after many hours spent talking to Dr. Helen Caldicott, the Nobel Prize nominee and the woman who stopped the above-ground testing in the Pacific, I felt differently. I felt we needed to shut them down as soon as possible, and now I feel that stronger than ever.
Is Vermont Yankee the first nuke to be closed not because of an accident? Arnie?
Just about the same time Vermont Yankee shut down, another plant shut down called Kewaunee out in Minnesota, Wisconsin, because it was no longer economical. The same year, three other power plants shut down because they broke, two in California and one in Florida. So in 1 year, five nuclear power plants permanently shut down. And since then, there's been announcements for the Pilgrim plant in Massachusetts shutting down on money in 2019, and the Oyster Creek plant in New Jersey shutting down because of money in 2019 as well, and the possibility of as many as five in Illinois and four in New York State as well, all because of money. The Vermont Yankee is the bow wave of that issue. Plants that structurally haven't broken, but just make no economic sense to run.
What was the key to closing Vermont Yankee? What tipped the balance there?
I got to give credit to the citizens of the state of Vermont. You know, the Entergy owned 12 plants, and the one plant they decided to shut down was Vermont Yankee. So I think it was citizens' activism across the state. You know, it was the New England Coalition. It was VPIRG. There's a permanent lobbyist, Bob Stannard, who was involved. And I think the work of Maggie and I, you know, we were necessary but not sufficient. It was a concerted effort. Peter Shumlin, obviously, was involved in that effort. Vermonters never wanted Vermont Yankee. And finally, when the economic tide began to turn, Entergy pulled the plug.
Maggie Gunderson.
And Peter Bradford, a former NRC commissioner, resides here in Peru, Vermont, and he was head of the New York State federal regulatory agency, New York State regulatory agency for power plants. He brought a lot to bear also. He and Arnie both consulted to the state of Vermont at the same time. And you know, I think a lot of people played a role using their skills to inform people in Vermont what was really happening. And I have to give the media some credit too, especially Susan Smallhair with the Rutland Herald and Dave Graham with Associated Press. Dave was the first one. 2007, we did an expose for the legislature about slush fund or trust fund, you know, the money to decommission Vermont Yankee is short. And he did such a thorough job that became a national press story that every plant in the U.S. is underfunded and every community in the U.S. is getting stuck with these costs.
And there's one other thing, and we all can think back to 2010 when, you know, Entergy lied under oath. And in Vermont, you're only as good as your word. And all of those members of the public were against it, and then they shot themselves in the foot.
So how many nuclear plants are still operating in the U.S.?
There's 99 today. There were 104 2 years ago.
And what is the greatest threat to people from these existing plants, as somebody who knows them from the inside, Arnie Gunderson?
Well, I am terribly concerned about seismic threats. These plants totally underestimate the magnitude of the earthquake. And there's a plant in California that's true for Diablo Canyon. But also Indian Point, right over here on the Hudson River. When it was built, they didn't realize there was an earthquake fault line a mile away that could produce an earthquake much worse than it had ever anticipated. So East Coast earthquakes jeopardize 60 or 70 power plants, and there's a few on the West Coast too. I think my biggest concern is terrorism and earthquakes.
I'm curious, Arnie Gunderson, I mean, the arc of your career, beginning as a nuclear energy, a nuclear engineer, to walking the streets of an abandoned city in Japan, what was that like for you personally to be in that apocalyptic landscape?
I kept asking myself, how did I ever believe that this was going to work? I guess that pretty much says all I can say. I'm getting choked up here. How can I ever believe that back in the 70s, how did I ever believe that this was going to work? I have a saying when I give speeches that sooner or later, in any foolproof system, the fools are going to exceed the proofs. And I didn't understand that as a young cub engineer right out of college and as an executive. But boy, I understand it now.
Was it was being there, I mean, did it kind of just disturb you to your core? It sounds like it caused a lot of reflection.
You know, the inhumanity of the Japanese government to its own people was amazing. I ran into a woman who, she was within 3 miles of the disaster when it happened. She lost her hair. She had bloody nose for 2 months, and her body was speckled with these welts. And her doctor told us it was stress. And I'm saying, it's not stress. This woman's got, you know, high levels of radiation exposure. And so the Japanese establishment that's driven by the Japanese government is deliberately falsifying information. Now, I shouldn't be surprised. I saw that on Three Mile Island. I was part of it for a long period of time. But the falsification of the consequences of the accident. When Fukushima happened, that very first day I said to Maggie, I said, I see it happening again. I can see the cover-up that I saw at Three Mile Island happening again, and I am not going to let that happen in Japan like it did here in America.
What would your advice be to a young Arnie Gunderson who may be emerging from any number of, you know, top schools to begin a career in perhaps an environmentally dubious industry?
The president of Duke Power was asked that. He was a nuclear engineer and he was retiring. And they said, what would your advice be to a young engineer? And he said, I would be building solar. He said, it's much easier to play offense than it is defense. And that would be my advice. You know, there's so many renewable alternatives out there. I just gave a speech up in Montreal last week at McGill. And the topic was this issue, oh, nukes are saving the world from CO2. They're not. They're the most expensive way to mitigate CO2. And if you've got the money, you're six or seven times better spent on renewables than to build a single nuke.
And the debate in Vermont around renewables and siting, how do you reflect on that now? What would be your input into that?
Well, I've seen an area the size of Vermont totally destroyed by a nuclear plant. I've seen probably in Fukushima there's 50,000 construction workers moving dirt and digging up radioactive hotspots and moving them and things like that. So when compared to the alternative, I'd say build as many renewables as you possibly can and shut down these nukes as quickly as possible.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Arnie Gunderson and Maggie Gunderson head Fairwinds Energy Education. Arnie Gunderson, a famous whistleblower in the nuclear industry as well. Thanks, both of you, for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Glad to be here.
And that does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this and all shows at VermontConversation.com. We'll be back next Wednesday at 1 with another Vermont Conversation.
This hour has been presented by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, featuring interviews with leading change makers from around Vermont and around the world. It's underwritten by The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community and Vermont since 2003. By UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. By Vermont National Life Group, which lives its values every day. Do good, be good, make good. By Coffee World, your local digital print shop, offering quick design and printing services for projects of all sizes. By Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy innovations while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. As well as over 750 VBSR businesses.